Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is Episode 7. By the way, Wild Trekker is a series of weekly 50-minute podcasts, a happening, like dipping into a writer's notebook. Wild Trekker presents audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews, reflections, original plays, stories behind stories, jam sessions with musicians, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. Here's an interview I conducted a few years ago with marine biologist Richard Sears. 40 years ago, he founded the Mangan Island Cetacean Study in order to research whales in the Gulf of St. Lawrence in eastern Canada. The Gulf is like an inland sea in between Newfoundland, the lower north shore of Quebec, and the provinces of New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and Nova Scotia. Many of the whales that interest him migrate south to the Caribbean for the winter. Richard Sears shares insights into whale behavior based on a fascinating career of research there. Do you find working with blue whales that your perspective on nature and on what's going on in other species has really changed?
Well, I would say that, first of all, just working on animals in the oceans or in the water has it can't help but change your continuously how you look at them, and how do you try to change your approach to studying these animals, because for one, you're dealing with this barrier which we're not that adroit at getting through and working in. I mean, we're very slow in the water, very inadequate, even if we use submarines, which of course we don't, but not just working on blue whales, because we work on finbacks, humpbacks, minkies, other cetaceans. And I would say that I could answer it this way. The first years when I started really doing this here in the St. Lawrence in the late 70s, early 80s, we were just out there trying to figure out how many animals were in an area, which way they were going. And as we started doing it more and more days, more and more months, we realized that some of the preconceptions we had about how these animals might be moving, you know, very simplistic ideas, would change the longer we would do it. So very quickly, I had already been sort of convinced that long-term studies were important, but by doing it ourselves, it became more and more clear that the long-term studies are essential, especially for long-lived animals. And perhaps not just long-lived animals, actually also ones that live shorter amount of time. But it's much more fun doing the work now, because as opposed to in the early 80s, where we were just going out and saying, okay, that's a blue whale and that's a finback and there's 10 of them and they're here again off of Anticosti Island or something. Now, when we go out, we know the individuals, we know the sex of those individuals because we've been able to take biopsies over time. And so it changes automatically, or not automatically, it changes progressively your way of looking at these animals, because it opens up doors that you didn't have at the beginning. So you're able to try and make a little more sense about how the animals are interacting between each other. And that all those things change, and it makes it a lot more fun. There were times in the early years where you go, okay, I've got this number of blue whales. I can present this in a paper or present this in a talk. We have 60 blue whales identified. And okay, that's new. It's something that wasn't known before. But you wondered sometimes where we were going with all this, because it was still very much hidden the lives of these animals. And it's now a little less hidden, I'd say, after almost 29 seasons. So your perspectives or your way of doing, seeing things change slowly, but it does become, in my view at least, a lot more fun because you're able to delve a little bit more into their lives.
When you listen to the songs of humpbacks or blue whales, do you believe that they are sharing experiences or information in a language, or is it sound, which is sort of automatic, or could it be considered to be music of some sort?
Well, first of all, I don't work on acoustics personally that much, but I have listened to humpback sounds. I first of all just marvel at the number of sounds they can produce. I mean, you can have humpbacks making sounds that are melodic, and you could have humpbacks that sound as though they're a Triumph Bonneville. I mean, they just sound like a motorcycle with a loud muffler, and they're very varied. We do know from the humpback work done in mostly off Hawaii by other researchers and the places where they reproduce that the it's the males that produce most of the varied sounds that we hear, and it probably has something to do with reproduction. It may not be, it's probably not to attract females, but more a communication between males, perhaps sort of establishing a type of territory, if you can have one out there in the water. As Chris Clark likes to call them, the humpbacks certainly are sort of like the jazz musicians. Now, do they use it as kind of a song or as producing music? I have no idea, but it's certain that the sounds that they produce change. They delete pieces of the song or the vocalizations that they do. They add new pieces. So it's evolving or it's changing over time. Now, with blue whales and finbacks, we don't hear it. And with a humpback, what's nice is you can put a hydrophone over the side, even here in the St. Lawrence, beginning in late September, certainly in October. You can start hearing the humpbacks make what we call the song. And as the season progresses, before the animals leave the St. Lawrence, by the end of October, early November, you have some very, very long bits of humpback song that you can hear, and from quite a distance. So it's very, very interesting to put a hydrophone in the water. Some people think that they only make these sounds in the breeding grounds. Well, that's not the case. You can hear them making these sounds before they migrate. And then during the summer, you could put a hydrophone in and hear little grunts and chirrumps and things like that the humpbacks make. And that may be both the males and females, and it's probably just little social sounds when animals, perhaps when they meet up, perhaps when they discover food, who knows? We don't know enough about that. Whereas blue whales and finbacks and other species make sounds that we can't hear for the most part. It would be very, on a rare occasion, you can hear the very deep, low pulse sounds of a blue whale or a finback. So most of those sounds are listened to in a lab by people who have accelerated the sound of these whales to be able to hear them. And so most of the analysis is done, or most of the hearing of that sound is done in not a natural setting, let's say.
Is it possible to hear belugas at the surface?
Oh, yeah. At the surface? What do you mean, the sound, the breathing of a beluga, or just the vocalizations? Well, certainly belugas can be heard, widely where you are. If you're up in the St. Lawrence Estuary, you can put a hydrophone in and you can hear them across. If you're at Forestville, you can hear some over at Bick. So it's because sound travels very well underwater. Now, I presume that I don't work on belugas that much, but the people that do might say they've heard them. I know I've heard humpback sounds when I've worked in the Caribbean. I've heard humpback sounds above the water, even over the sound of the motor. If the motor's just in idle, you can hear the sounds of humpbacks. And if you sleep on a ship on Silver Bank, though this is a bank north of Dominican Republic, where the humpbacks, one of the places where they congregate for mating and breeding and birthing purposes, perhaps in the Caribbean, I've been awakened, as I'm sure many people have, on a wooden ship, sleeping in the boat or on deck. All of a sudden you feel that you're dreaming about humpback singing. And in fact, there's one right under the ship making a lot of noise and it wakes you up because you can hear the right through the hull. And so you wake up and then you sit there for a while and try and get back to sleep. And if you were to put a hydrophone in the water on Silver Bank, there's so many humpbacks making sounds. It sounds almost like kind of a horror movie. It's just a, you know, one vocalizing over the other. There's no real harmony to it. And when you get to single individuals or a couple, it's a little bit easier to, a little bit more pleasing to the ears, let's say, than about 10 or 15 humpbacks all making sounds at the same time. But maybe that's how they think about us if they hear us.
I remember camping once with my family at Bergeron, just below Tadoussac, northeast of Tadoussac. And during the night, we could hear what sounded like very distant singing. It sounded almost like a party. And we listened to it, and we could hear whales just offshore, maybe 10 meters offshore in the trench there, breathing and occasionally spouting. But we could hear this distant sound, and the next day we asked people what it was, and they said that was belugas, that you can occasionally hear them when they're right at the surface. And they do stay a lot at the surface.
Well, I mean, that's certainly possible. I've never heard that, but you know, I don't spend that much time around belugas. But at night, I've been in bays along there where you were, and you can certainly hear the breathing of all these different whales, which is pretty impressive at night in the stillness. And, you know, different animals breathe a little differently. Finbacks sound a little more like somebody's blowing over the top of a bottle when they breathe in. But if you have humpbacks around, you would certainly could hear humpbacks trumpeting or making sounds, because some of the sounds they make are very, very recognizable in, at the surface. I mean, you know, trumpeting, sort of like elephants when they're annoyed or just interacting amongst themselves. With blue whales, there is sort of an equivalent we've come to recognize. We call it rumble breath. It's sort of akin to the sound of a truck on air brakes coming down a hill, and it sort of just goes bum like this. And I've often noticed it in situations where females are being approached by males, and they may be showing annoyance, you know, sort of get away from me, you bugger, I don't want to have anything to do with you. But or when there's a pair of whales, when blue whales, we know that when you see a pair that's a long-term pair, it's a female in front and a male behind. And I don't mean by that that they're pairing up for life or even for that season. They're just maybe two animals hanging out together for a couple days or weeks, where the male may be hoping that eventually he might be able to mate with that female, but there's no guarantee of that. So you get those kind of sounds. And again, I think your point is a very interesting one about being on shore at night just listening. One of the banes of our existence is working with outboard motors, and what we try to do is shut them off as much as we can. And certainly I enjoy greatly the being on a sailboat the few times we have been, and just listening to animals breathing at night. And you do hear little nuances in the sounds of that and perhaps vocalizations that you wouldn't hear normally during the day.
You have cataloged quite a few blue whales in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. About how many do you think you've cataloged?
Well, I know how many we've cataloged. We have exactly 409 blue whales in our mug book, if you want. But we don't know how many of those have died. We only know of two of the ones we haven't cataloged that have died, because we were lucky enough. They were unlucky enough to have died and beached, and we were lucky enough to be able to get to them and recognize them before their skin peeled or something like that. So we have 409 over 28 field seasons. How many of those have died? We have no idea. So the catalog may actually number 300 and something animals. We don't know. But by having these mug books or catalogs, photo ID catalogs of whales, it permits us to find out more about their dispersal and distribution. For instance, what we found out recently is, and this is for animals not in the St. Lawrence or Eastern Canadian New England waters, but we had also been collecting pictures off of Iceland in the Azores, and recently we got some really very interesting information. A guy, an Australian, who happened to be off of Northwest Africa, off Mauritania, very luckily took pictures of three blue whales he saw off of a seismic vessel, of all things, there. And he kindly sent me the pictures, and one of them I recognized right away was an animal I had seen twice in Iceland. At the time, I did not know that those pictures came from Mauritania, so I assumed that they were somewhere around Iceland. And I eventually found out where he had taken these. And so there was our first match between Northwest Africa and Iceland. And that's like hitting a grand slam. And then we had another match from pictures taken last spring in the Azores, where we have a catalog of about 40 animals. And one of those animals also matched to Iceland, which was something I was expecting. We just didn't have a big enough samples of IDs from the Azores to get that done, apparently. So there we have a skeleton of distribution given to us by photo identification. In the St. Lawrence, we have animals matched to New England, to the Scotian Shelf, one to West Greenland, but most of the animals are animals known from our work in the St. Lawrence.
But do they tend to stay in the area of the Gulf of St. Lawrence or the Northwest Atlantic?
They would certainly stay in the Western North Atlantic, I would believe. And then there does seem to be stock separation between the ones we see known as the Eastern Canadian animals and the ones off of Iceland, and which we now know are also Azores in Northwest Africa. Maybe we'll find out that the animals from Eastern Canada also go to Mauritania. We don't have any indications of that at the moment. And in fact, the ones from here in the Gulf of St. Lawrence move around quite a bit. To answer your question, in the summer months, there's probably about 30 to 40% of the animals that we have in the catalog that you could expect to see, that would be animals you wouldn't be surprised to see in the St. Lawrence somewhere. But there are many others that we don't see regularly. There are some animals we have had animals we've re-sighted after 22 years. Now, we may have missed them. We may not have been in the right place when they were here, so they may have been here more regularly. But there are certainly some animals that are not regular visitors to the St. Lawrence and others that are very regular visitors to the St. Lawrence. And what we need to find out, we need to get out and work more off of outside the St. Lawrence. We need to get out on the Grand Banks, on the shelf edge of the Grand Banks, on the shelf edge of the Scotian Shelf, and we need to get out to places like the Flemish Cap. And those, of course, are difficult places to get to that require more important funding, and we just haven't been able to get it so far. But once we're able to get out in those areas, then and photograph some animals, we'll be able to get a better idea of how many blue whales there are in Eastern Canadian waters in New England. And are there many more than 400 that we have in the catalog, does that make up a very big proportion of the animals that exist off of the Canadian and New England coasts?
How far do whale songs travel underwater? Do you have any idea?
Well, somebody asked me that the other day down in the Antarctic, and there's a slide that Chris Clark, who works at Cornell in acoustics, gave me, which shows, it's actually from the U.S. Navy, and it shows sort of a diagram of the North Atlantic with showing the eastern seaboard of Canada and the United States all the way down to Florida, and showing the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and then it has a hypothetical blue whale positioned on the east side of Bermuda, and how far would the sound propagate from a blue whale, that blue whale, and it would get all the way to the eastern seaboard, and it could get all the way to the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Now, would that vocalization be effective to another blue whale that's somewhere in that radius of sound that's coming out from it? We don't know, because it depends on where the animal is in the water column, where the other one is in the water column, what the densities of water are, and so on. But it shows that a sound from a blue whale could reach at least that far. Now, there are some people that suggest that blue whales could communicate all the way around the planet. I suppose in theory, that's possible. But in practice, from practical terms, I think it's unlikely that it would be useful. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I think that certainly these animals can communicate over tens of miles effectively, perhaps hundreds of miles effectively. Can a blue whale hear another blue whale, you know, around the corner from the estuary, around the corner of Gaspé? Maybe. But maybe they don't. They probably don't depend on it that much. I think that if you're a blue whale that's in front of Rivière Renard and there's another one at Matane or Forestville, there's a good chance you can hear what what other blue whales are doing in other spots, and that could help make you decide to go there, because you could say, aha, that animal seems to be making this kind of sound, and so maybe something's going on. There's a lot of food there, or else it's just there's a bunch of males up there, so then maybe there's some females as well. Maybe I'm going to go up and see what's happening in that area, and see if I can socialize with some females or something.
I guess we like to project onto the animal world human behaviors or capabilities. Have you learned to develop a new mindset when you look at blue whales in the St. Lawrence?
Yeah, I suppose it's a natural thing for us to do, but as I've done this work over time, I've tried to, I was going to say divorce myself, but separate myself out more and more from giving, from having human perspectives on these animals' lives. And I think also, even in science, still to this day, we are still dominated by our human culture, which includes religion and all kinds of other things. And I think that the more that we're able to get ourselves away from that, and we may be able to keep it for ourselves personally if we want, but the more we're able to get ourselves away from that, I think gives us a chance and being able to get a more clear idea of the natural history of any animals that we're studying. And I think that having said that, I think I'm also amused sometimes at the similarities, and in a very zoological way, a very mammalian way, there's similarities sometimes there are between humans and other animals, or between other animals and other animals. You know, I mean, it doesn't have to be just humans and other species. And I think it's important that I think that science is still hindered by that, or at least biological observation is still hindered by that, because we are still surprised by the complexity that other animals offer, and we're still surprised by the by what we discover about these animals, not just surprised by what we discover in the process of learning about them, but that we discover that they're perhaps more complex than we thought, or that they have behaviors at least as complex as some of the ones that we have, because we have this sort of ethno-ego-centric idea that we are the ones that have the corner on complex behavior, and I just don't believe that's the case. And I think by getting yourself away from that those many human attitudes, you're able to see perhaps give yourself a chance to see more clearly into these other animals' lives. And the problem is, as I said earlier, we deal with the ocean surface, so we can only see them maybe 5% of the time. So that hinders us further. And you have to spend a lot of time in the field watching them and building on what you already know about these animals to get a chance to discover things more in depth about their lives.
I remember when... Sure it does. I remember at Bergeron one time seeing a female, a mother, blue, and a baby blue.
And you saw one of the very few calves we've seen in the St. Lawrence, because we've only had 16 calves we've found in 29 years. And sorry to interrupt you on that, but if you look at Iceland, where we...
I missed that. You should tell me that again.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's amazing to me, because I presume you probably haven't spent that much time looking at whales, at least not compared to some of us. And you were lucky enough to see one of the very rare blue whale calves that have shown up in the St. Lawrence. And if you compare it to the work we've done in Iceland, where I've maybe been a total of 50 days on the water over 10 years... So, you know, here I'm on the water maybe 100 days in a season, maybe more, and collectively in the field team, maybe many more than that. We've only seen 16 calves since 1979, whereas in Iceland, we already have 16 calves sighted in many fewer days. So there's something going on. It may be related to pollutants, either the blue whales here are affected by pollution and not reproducing as much as we think they should be, or the females, when they have calves, don't come as much into the St. Lawrence. I would think that that's unlikely, because we have about a 50-50 sex ratio, and we know of many mature females that come regularly into the St. Lawrence, and then on occasion we do see one of those well-known females with calves. So that doesn't seem to be the case. So you were very lucky to see that calf.
I was surprised, because I'd actually been staying in Bergeron for about 4 or 5 days and had seen almost nothing. And just as I was packing up my bags to leave, there, sure enough, was the mother and a calf. There were the mother and a calf just offshore, and they were diving and coming back to the surface and flourishing their tails and diving again over and over again.
The calf wasn't fluking, was it? I mean, I would be surprised if the calf was fluking up.
The female, the mother was...
Okay, so do you remember what year that was?
This was 2 years ago.
Okay, well, that's, you most likely saw kingfisher in her calf. Kingfisher is a, sounds like a masculine name, but it has, it has a kingfisher sort of outlined in the modeling on the side, and that, that female is, that is very regularly seen in the St. Lawrence, so she's well known by the whale watching boats as well as by us, and she did come back with a calf 2 summers ago, and so yeah, you saw a kingfisher, who's a very healthy big female, and we've had one calf from her so far that we know of.
The way I felt at the time, though, I couldn't help feeling they had to be playing and not just diving and looking for food. They had to be playing.
Well, I don't know what you saw, but certainly these animals play, and certainly a mother will, you know, have fun with her calf, and the calf will certainly be like other young of different species and be a more playful, check out boats, be more surface active, perhaps. I mean, I know in Baja, where we work on blue whales, we see many more calves there. We maybe have 16-17% of the animals we see are calves. So we have younger animals, again, than the ones you might see in the St. Lawrence in the spring or summer. But we've had, one day we had the great luck to have a blue whale calf want to swim around our boat for 3 hours, and we were able to get in, and the calf was unbelievable. I mean, it's a rare thing. I mean, sometimes you'll have them coming over for one or two passes of the boat, and the mother of this calf was 400, 500 meters away and very content that its calf had found some new toys to play with. And I remember getting in the water and having it make several passes, which is what they usually do, and then the animal got comfortable with us, and it would slow down for these very inept creatures, us, that it was looking at, and it would slow right down and just almost stop, because we're very slow swimmers, humans, and even with fins on, and the calf virtually stopped right next to me, and I was able to look at it right in eye to eye, and it was checking me out and stuff like that, and we were able to get in and out of the water, change our film, take breaks, have a sandwich, get back in, and this animal stayed with us for 3 hours.
You know what was going on in your mind, but what was going on in the calf's mind?
Well, it was discovering something else probably in its environment, the boat, the noise from the boat, these funny little things that came out of the boat. You know, these, does it perceive us as being sort of pinkish little things or whatever in our case? It certainly was fascinated by what we were. I mean, it kept coming by and checking us out, and we made little noises of glee probably when we were in the water with it. And I remember on one occasion we all happened to be back where there were four of us. We all got back in the boat, and we were either changing film in our cameras or getting another video cassette. And the whale sort of seemed, at least to my perception, to get a little bit annoyed because there was nobody in the water, and it started blowing bubbles through its blowhole. It changed its behavior when we weren't in the water and swimming around the boat, and it was a little bit agitated. And then when one of us got back in, it said, oh, okay, you're back in, and I can check you out some more. So it was curious, and obviously it didn't make any alarm calls because it's mother didn't come over, and we kept expecting the female to show up, and that this calf was already 30 feet long, so, you know, it's pretty big. But if the mother had showed up, she was probably around 80, and that would have been even more of an impressive sight. But no, she never came over. She was content to stay off to the side, not worried apparently about what was going on with her calf. Other situations, the mother and calf will be more nervous and move away from you. But often what we see in Baja, if you approach these animals gently, as with most species, us included, you tend to get a lot more, the animals are more receptive to you. You can give them more time to get used to you. And I think that's the whole trick with any animal, really, is just to give it time to get used to the presence if we're going to be in their sphere, so to speak. And eventually, cows with calves will be quite used to you. The calf might move underneath the mother and over to the other side, but after a while the calf will stay on the side where you are. If you don't make any sudden changes in the motor, or you aren't being aggressive or perceived as being aggressive, then the animals will accept you much more.
Do you ever feel, comparing blue whales to humans, that blue whales are more peaceful, better intentioned than humans?
I think probably
more laid back.
I don't know about laid back. I could say that you could probably say that about most animals vis-a-vis humans. I think, you know, blue whales, I mean, you know, you have to be careful because whales are as I said, mostly underwater, so they appear very laid back because we see them come up to breathe and sort of gently move off. Are they more laid back than us? I think probably, I'm going to reinforce what I just said. I think probably vis-a-vis us, most animals are more laid back. I mean, I suppose you could say that a squirrel that's scurrying around collecting, you know, food for its winter doesn't look that laid back. It's a little hyper. But I think they certainly teach those of us that work on them to be more laid back in our approach and calm, because you don't get anywhere if you're more aggressive about approaching them. Humpback whales are more boisterous, certainly, but they seem to express themselves more than some of these other animals. Right whales, the same thing. Some of the Brutus whales, which are a similar species to sei whales or fin whales, but found more in the tropics, they can be quite curious and intrigued by us. Humpbacks will come over and put their flippers on us, which is something to be avoided because the flipper is not light, but they do it gently. they do it gently. Whereas blue whales are, and fin whales, I often say they're sort of more business as usual. They sort of go along. They're not, in general, that interested in us. They, you know, if anything, if we're being noisy, they kind of want to avoid us. Blue whales, I think, compared to finbacks, for instance, tend to be a little more nervous about us than finbacks. Finbacks, you can get in amongst them very gently. I hesitate to say this because then the whale watching guys will say you can do this. But if you come in, you know, almost in neutral and glide with your motor off, a group of finbacks will accept you quite easily. Blue whales in general are more nervous. Now, did we kill off all the easygoing ones when we whaled? Who knows? It's possible. It would make some sense that the ones that were more approachable ended up, unfortunately, killed more easily than the ones that weren't. So maybe we were left with just all the nervous blue whales. And I say that, you know, jokingly. I think that, as with any species that one, if one is taking the time to study them, that if you're able to get yourself accepted by them and find a way to just sit and observe them without deteriorating their environment by your sound that we might produce with outboards, we like to shut off our engines as much as possible and just watch. And if the problem is sometimes these animals move a certain distance between surfacings, but sometimes they don't. And those instances, you can really sit and observe them and watch what they're doing and the interactions between individuals. You know, some of the females we've gotten to know in the estuary, there's one we call Jawbreaker, and she wasn't named because she had a more aggressive personality, just because of some pigmentation pattern. But it turns out the Jawbreaker, in my view, certainly doesn't let herself be imposed upon by males. She'll tolerate certain males to follow along with her, but if she doesn't want them there anymore, I've seen what I believe is her turning back and confronting them sort of head on, sometimes doing a little bit of that rumble breath I was talking about. And after that, the male says, okay, I got the message, and backs away and either goes off towards another group of animals or off on its own. So there are slowly emerging personalities from these blue whales the more time we're able to spend with them. With humpbacks, you get to see their personality much more quickly. They let you know what they like or don't like, and they are much more vocal at the surface or even underwater using hydrophones amongst themselves. They breach. They, in other words, jump out of the water. They hit their flippers on the water. They're much more expressive. So they're perhaps the more akin to us of the whales, because they're more noisy. We're an incredibly noisy species, humans. Everything we do almost is noisy. The more you spend time on the water, the more you seek stillness, like your moment in Grande Bergeau in there, where you had a quiet evening camped out on the rocks. Those are things that we really seek out more and more. And if you can have, I agree that being able, when you're able, the rare places where you're able to watch whales from shore, that's a great, great thing, because they can be 50 meters off and you can watch them without feeling that you're interfering with them.
If we think back to the last glaciation, the St. Lawrence Valley, the area from Montreal up to Ottawa and parts of Lake Champlain in southern Quebec and northern Vermont were actually under the Champlain Sea, and fossils have been found of bowheads, belugas, and humpbacks in this area. That was a long time ago, like 12,000 years ago. It seems that the water level was maybe 150 meters higher at Montreal than it is today. Isn't that as an indication that the climate is subject to periodic changes that affect different species?
Well, yeah, I think that there's a history of climate change that glaciologists and geologists and so forth have brought forward over time. Yeah, that's certainly. I mean, I think it is interesting to think of the ice sheet pushing animals further south, and then as the ice sheets retreat, you see them repopulating or taking back areas where they were. And of course, with the Champlain Sea, that was a time when they could be, there could be whales, you know, there were whales swimming along up here where we're sitting right now. And
Here in Montreal,
I think, yeah. And then as you see it changing, I mean, look at the opposite end of it. As the ice recedes now in this warming period, most probably accelerate, most likely, or actually more and more proof shows that we are accelerating it. But when you look at what's happening to the Arctic, the polar ice, it won't be long that whales will be able to swim around the polar waters and end up from the Atlantic into the Pacific or the other way. And actually, there is already an example of one hooded seal, apparently from the eastern Arctic, that made its way all the way down to San Diego. So I won't be surprised if in the future somebody says, wait a minute, this is a blue whale or a humpback or from the Atlantic that's shown up in the Pacific, and that'll really screw up what we're doing. Because all of a sudden we'll have mixing stocks and population estimates will go through, will be further, even more difficult to get than they are already now.
Do you think that the supply of food for blue whales is subject to change in the Gulf of St. Lawrence?
Sure, I think it's a possibility that that will happen, and it may have already happened, not necessarily because of global warming or anything, but because of an imbalance caused by us in the food chain because of the fact that cod were removed from it. It's something that there's a student working with us now, and this is a project in conjunction with Fisheries and Oceans at Mont-Joli. I just had the idea that in the early years at Mingan, we had a lot of blue whales. They were very regularly sighted there from August on till November and probably into December. We just weren't there to see them in December. And then all of a sudden, by the early 90s, most of the blue whales seemed to choose another place for some reason. There was no increased level of boat activity in that area or anything of that sort. It's actually, fishing had decreased because the cod were disappearing. And I've been wondering for a long why this happened. Because, and then on top of it, some of the blue whales that we were seeing regularly in Mingan didn't just show up in the estuary or off Gaspé. They just vanished. There are about 20 or so animals that just haven't been seen again. Some of the individuals we saw in Mingan regularly, a couple males I can think of, we still do see in the St. Lawrence. One was B17, we call Scythe. That animal's been very regularly sighted. And another one we call Noctop from a notch in its dorsal fin, B002. So you can see they were early animals for our catalog that are still seen. But the others have vanished. And we thought that as we increased our coverage of at least the western St. Lawrence from the Gaspé and the North Shore, that we would have a chance of finding these animals. Well, we haven't. So what happened? Well, either these animals were all died for something catastrophic, and I don't think that's what happened. We know one of them died. Or they chose to go to another place for some reason. And interestingly enough, at that time, humpback whales were starting to increase, both in numbers from probably where they had been more commonly found off Gaspé, where they're still seen in June and July, but also in numbers reproductively. I mean, there were... we have now some seasons where we have, I think two summers ago, including the Blanc-Sablon humpbacks, we had 16 calves, something like that. Finback whale calving has been increasing. So there's a steady source of food for these animals. And we know that humpbacks and finbacks will eat krill or euphausids, but they'll also eat fish. They'll eat capelin, sandlats, herring, squid. And interestingly enough, and there are some indications from this, from some of the fisheries surveys, the amount of capelin is very solid along the North Shore and probably sandlats. And so is it because the cod that used to prey on these other species of fish have been removed from the water column, that the capelin and sandlats and perhaps other species have increased. And because the capelin feeds on euphausids, have they been hammering the euphausids or the krill that's in that area? And that the blue whale found too much competition from fish to have adequate access to krill that they moved to other areas. On the other hand, the humpbacks found it to their liking because there were more and more fish or greater quantities of capelin and sand lance or other species. And so both the finback and the humpback have benefited from this change in the water column, in the food chain. Anyway, this is something that we'd like to discover. This may not be the case at all, but it could be the case. So something where we've had a very direct impact on one species, the cod, which may have had impacts all along the food chain and all the way back, if you want, to blue whales.
Is it true that northern right whales are in really bad shape?
Oh, yeah. Well, right whales were reduced to very low numbers by whaling. They never really have come back to where now the best estimates show them at being anywhere between 300 and 350 individuals. And the problem for right whales, because they can be an inshore species, they are very slow moving, which is one of the reasons why they're called the right whale. They were one of the right whales to kill because they were easy to get at. Well, these animals are hit, struck by ships, they're caught in fishing gear, and it's a constant battle particularly in the Gulf of Maine and along the eastern seaboard, where animals are entangled in fishing gear. There are teams of people, and a lot of money is spent to disentangle these animals from the fishing gear. That happened to us once in Mingan, one right whale we saw there had some crab pots on its flippers. It seemed to get free of them while we were there. Plus, right whales are very difficult to work on because, as opposed to humpbacks, where they're caught in a net, you can pull on the line basically, and they sort of go ouch, and they don't move, and you can sort of disentangle them more easily. Right whales tend to get nasty about it, which you'd think all whales would, and they'll charge you, or they're much more dangerous to try and disentangle than our humpbacks, for instance. So, yeah, and every time you lose one or two females from that population of very low numbers of right whales, well, you lose a very significant proportion of the genetics of that group. One person has already calculated in a paper, has presented that right whales could be gone within the next 200 years or by 200 years from now. So, and blue whales are probably in a little bit better shape than our right whales. There seems to be more genetic diversity in the blue whales that remain. But until we find out really conclusively how many blue whales there are in the eastern Canadian population, their story is a little bit up in the air as well.
Belugas are making a comeback of sorts in the St. Lawrence?
Belugas seem to be making a comeback. There's still a toll taken on them from pollutants and so forth. There's still animals found washed up and so on, and they still have high levels of pollutants in them, and that's because that species resides year-round in the St. Lawrence, or they're bathed in this soup that we keep presenting them with that comes out of North America. I think, first of all, when the first studies were being presented, the number of belugas may have been a little bit lower, may have been estimated lower than they actually were. But I think that there's, if I remember, the last figures seem to be around 1,000 or so belugas in the St. Lawrence. And if we can find ways to reduce their toxic load and give them areas where they can reproduce and live without too much interference, perhaps they'll start inching upwards and get back to what they were supposed to be, around 5,000 some odd of them at one time back in the 1920s or something.
When I did whale watching trips, I always thought of myself as invading the space of whales. But one time I was in the prow of a boat in thick fog, and everyone had gone below decks to have a coffee because it was so cold. It was off Rimouski. And suddenly the motor was off, and suddenly a blue whale came up right in front of the ship and spouted on me. I don't know if it was intentional, but...
No, probably not. It just happened to come up in the spot and where you guys were. And, I mean, I've had many of these whales spout, because we're close to them. I've gotten sprayed regularly by these animals. I have had a couple of cases where humpbacks will come up, not necessarily spout on us, but they will line us up and splash the boats with their tails. So that I've seen whales do. But Finbacks and blue whales seem to be a lot more polite in their way of dealing with us, and perhaps too much so. But I think those moments when you can be in fog and enjoy, again, a quiet moment and hear them breathing and have them come up close like that, it gives you a little bit, there is sort of a magic to that, because you're not, we're not imposing our will on them at that moment.
It's a very powerful jet of, I don't know what.
Well, it's mostly seawater, because when they're exhale, they start exhaling below the surface. So most of what you're getting hit with is salt water. But there are also some nice other things in the mucus of these whales that you probably don't want to know about it.
And there, we're back to Montreal. Here we are in 2019. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, literary translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net. And Evidencia is spelled E-V-I-D-E-N-T-I-A, Evidencia. You can also drop me a line on the contact page on that website. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2019, George Toombs, all rights reserved. Here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, with Pascal Desmilles accompanying her on the guitar. Let's get together soon. Bye for now.